Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your unknown pleasure of music criticism and junior pedagogy. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. Today, our guest is Nate Chinen. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Ben.
Nate has an article on Joey Alexander, the 11-year-old piano virtuoso from Bali, grew up in Indonesia, currently living in New Jersey. Is it his first?
It is.
I always hesitate before saying first with these prodigies because you know that they've got like five records put out by their parents.
He's been biding his time.
Yeah. So it's his first record called My Favorite Things on the Motema label, and coming in, we heard a little bit of Joey Alexander, the 11-year-old Joey Alexander playing My Favorite Things. So, Nate, the first question, how is Joey Alexander different from many other young jazz whiz kids that you and I have seen in various settings?
I think the way to answer it is to tell you how I first heard him and how most people here in New York first heard him playing a ballad. I was not at the Jazz at Lincoln Center Gala in 2014, at which he made his sort of momentous first appearance, but I was at a gala a few months later for the Jazz Foundation of America at the Apollo Theater. That evening was a tribute to Herbie Hancock, and as part of the program, they had Herbie come out, and then they brought out Joey Alexander, who I had heard about. I had seen some sort of semi-viral YouTube clips of. Mm-hmm. And then there he was. He sat down on the bench, and he played Round Midnight with Herbie basically at his elbow, watching very closely as he played, just solo. First of all, that's an extraordinary amount of pressure for a kid. And secondly, it was a pretty ravishing arrangement of this pretty difficult song. There's a lot of shades of complexity in this ballad. I think what we are accustomed to seeing from whiz kids is blinding speed and, you know, oodles and oodles of tricks. Let me show you what I've got.
Facility.
You know, it's a very youthful.
The gift.
Yeah, it's a youthful idea. You know, it's like I've got this like crazy talent and like here it comes. It's coming at you, you know? And with Joey Alexander, I was struck immediately by restraint and really thoughtful choices, judiciousness, things that you would think of when you used a word like mature to describe, you know, an arrangement of a song. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of just lodged in my head. I thought, there's something else going on here. You know, an interesting thing about his journey is that, you know, and I think this is what draws people like Hancock and Wynton Marsalis to his cause. He really doesn't have that throw the kitchen sink at you mentality. It's pretty measured and thoughtful. And when you think about who it's coming from and how old he is, kind of freakish.
When you see a young virtuoso playing jazz, seeing is really important. You know,
right.
Because there's always this like disjunctive moment when the little kid sits down on the bench or behind the drums or whatever, and what they do is so startling. You kind of can't believe your eyes.
Right.
But here's a record. Here's a CD. You're listening to it without the benefit of visuals.
Right.
I mean, I actually recently watched the entire video EPK of Joey Alexander's record with great interest. Because it's just, the visuals really count with a little kid like this. But so what's the experience of listening to this record without watching him?
It is pretty easy, I think, to forget this is a kid because of some of what I said, you know, the harmonic choices, the ways in which he seems to have put thought into arranging his material, the real sort of rapport that he has with the musicians on the record. And, you know, Motema got two very good rhythm teams to work with him on this record. One is the two guys that I saw with him at Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola, a drummer named Sammy Miller and a bassist named Russell Hall. The other one is Larry Grenadier on bass and Ulysses Owens Jr. on drums. You know, these two rhythm teams function in slightly different ways on this record, and he sounds good with both of them. You don't get a sense, as I've sometimes heard from, you know, from other prodigies, he's sort of doing his thing and the other guys are trying to kind of fit in mm-hmm. or somehow adapt to the thoroughbred chomping at the bit.
Mm-hmm.
He's really listening. You know, I think it's clear on a lot of this record, he's really listening to what's happening in this rhythm section. He's really thinking a couple steps ahead. You know, unless you are keeping the idea of him sort of, you know, front of mind, you know, you could just kind of enjoy it for what it is, which is, you know, pretty like highly accomplished modern jazz, squarely in the sort of modern mainstream. A lot of Herbie in there, a lot of Chick Corea in there, some Keith Jarrett in there, some Kenny Barron, maybe a splash of Oscar Peterson. You know, it's really kind of like a golden mean of post-war, you know, modern piano styles.
What about post-80s?
Maybe a little bit of Mulgrew Miller, probably some Marcus Roberts. I don't hear too much Kenny Kirkland. There's one name that looms large, and that's Brad Meldow.
Mm-hmm.
Joey does a version of a song called It Might As Well Be Spring. It's a song that the Brad Meldow Trio has played. Joey's arrangement is in 7/8, mm-hmm. which is something that Brad's trio was known for mm-hmm. In the 90s. And Larry Grenadier is a member of the Brad sure. Meldow Trio. The week that I met with Joey, Brad was at the Vanguard with his trio. And I saw the Brad Meldow Trio the night before I met Joey.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that to him. And he said, oh, yeah, I was there on Tuesday night. He has been digging Brad Meldow,
mm-hmm.
which, again, doesn't make him exceptional. Everybody's been digging Brad Meldow.
Mm-hmm.
But he's 11. Again, you know, he's thinking about what are ways to deal with this language that are, you know, that are interesting and new and that fit with what I can do. So, yeah, there's a lot of, you can hear echoes of a lot of stuff in his playing. It's early to say that he has, you know, a recognizable voice, but over the course of this album, he certainly does articulate some kind of, you know, aesthetic.
And does the 11-year-old piano whiz kid play Giant Steps? Of course the 11-year-old piano whiz kid plays
you
Giant
have to.
Steps.
You have
so
to.
Let's hear a little bit of that from this new record, My Favorite Things. Nate Chenin, talk about Giant Steps and Joey Alexander's way of dealing with it.
Well, this is a song from, can you call it a song? I think you can.
Yes, you can.
From John Coltrane's Harmonic Warrior phase. It was hugely important to the development of jazz harmony post-bebop. It's famously complicated with new chords, you know, basically, you know, every measure or sometimes every beat.
Every other beat. Yeah.
And so this has been, you know, an etude or an exercise or an obstacle course and, you know, used as a kind of, you know, litmus test. Can you hang? Can you handle this? You know, on some level, you know, him throwing this out there, I saw him play it at Dizzy's and it opens the album. You know, it's a little bit of throwing down the gauntlet and saying, like, yeah, I got this.
Mm-hmm.
But he does interesting things with the arrangement. It's not just one, two, one, two, three, mm-hmm. four, you know, mm-hmm. and straight through. He puts in these interludes and, you know, the tempo kind of slows and quickens and uses the rhythm section in ways that are really effective. Like, I don't want you guys just, you know, just burning the whole time. Let's kind of put some space in there and let's, you know, it's a very thoughtful approach to the tune. And when I asked him about it, he said, this is a song that can be very intense, but I was thinking about how much I love John Coltrane's voice, how much I love his sound. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something that felt like, you know, maybe not quite so intense. And my retort was, well, it does still get intense.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his father kind of laughed at that. But, you know, it's this idea of let's give you an experience. Let's give you something that doesn't just go from A to B and, you know, jump all these hurdles in the process. Let's kind of give you a sort of winding path that has some surprises and some interesting mm-hmm. turns and developments. And in the process, I'll show you all these different sides of what I can do here.
You know, there are some people who may be interested in music but don't pay a whole lot of attention to jazz per se, who might be puzzled with all the attention in the culture around jazz given to really young musicians. Because as we all know, there is something good about growing up and getting past some early stuff and then putting yourself out there.
Don't you think that this is, you know, it's sort of related to all of the like speed metal tykes on YouTube and classical prodigies? I mean, it seems like it comes from a similar wonderment of like
athleticism.
Crazy athletic precocity.
Well, right? Okay, so there's athleticism. But there's something else too, isn't there, in jazz culture? I mean, something nurturing, something about always looking toward the future.
Well, jazz is a super generational music, right? It's still connected. No matter how intellectualized it gets, it's still connected to the idea of a sort of folkloric passing on of information from elders to inheritors.
Yep.
Often in the best of cases, that happens in real time on a bandstand, happened in the great second Miles Davis quintet. You know, it happens to this day with a lot of the best, you know, bands we can point to.
Tony Williams
was
what, 15, 16 when he started in that group?
He was either 15 or 16. And he was, you know, he was, I think, 17 when he, you know, during the Four and More concert, which is, you know, maybe the greatest example of, you know, jazz drumming ever recorded. There's a way in which the mastery of technique that is so evident in a young jazz phenom, coupled with this kind of knowledge of a repertoire and of dynamics and listening and responding, you know, it's just there's so much that's required of someone working in this discipline.
Yeah.
You know, and this is not to denigrate a great, you know, young classical pianist, for instance, but there's a different order of alertness to the moment that is required for an improviser, you know, because there's no score. Giant Steps is a good example. There is a form, but outside of sort of hitting certain marks, there's an enormous amount of freedom. And to see what a young person can do with that freedom is exhilarating, you know?
Okay, so you answered the question, I think, very well. You know, in jazz, it's this enormous continuity. In jazz, you've got people who are 11 and you've got people who are 87.
Right.
They are essentially working on the same thing, generally speaking.
Yeah.
It's the same endeavor, which is quite amazing, especially because this is not per se the notated aspect of the music. The repertory aspect of the music is secondary to the invented, the improvisational.
Right.
But it's still interesting that this doesn't mostly happen behind the scenes. There's a desire to have the youngest players
and put them on display
front and center
in
the clubs to become commercial draws even. Joey Alexander might sell more records, might sell more copies of this record than we could name a lot of really great band leaders right now.
As of yesterday, I think it took him a few hours, and he knocked Kamasi Washington from the number one spot
Kamasi.
On the jazz iTunes
Kamasi.
Chart.
But congratulations.
Kamasi will be all right.
Yeah, congratulations, Joey.
I think some of that has to do with, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but jazz culture, you know, the jazz community has a lot of pride, also has a lot of insecurities. These things are borne out by, you know, market concerns. They're borne out by sort of a feeling about the music's tenuous place in the larger culture. When you see, first of all, that the core values of this art form have successfully been absorbed by someone as young as this, that's a pretty encouraging thing. That gives you faith.
Yes, it
does. That makes you believe, right?
Sure.
You know, there's something about the discovery that is there when someone is really going for it. And that's also there. And so I think that on some level, we celebrate this kind of thing. And, you know, I say we meaning like the jazz realm, because this is also being celebrated by a lot of people who have nothing to do with jazz, mm-hmm. don't really care about jazz.
Yeah.
The reason that jazz people rally behind a story like Joey's is because it tells us something good about ourselves. Mm-hmm. It tells us that we are preserving the culture. It tells mm-hmm. us that we are passing it on and that it is going to survive. And that maybe brings us to the sort of institutional support system mm-hmm. that Joey Alexander has received, which is pretty remarkable. And I think without which we would not be talking about him right now. Mm-hmm. And that's Jazz Lincoln Center. We've said that it was at a Jazz Lincoln Center gala that he made his big splash. That was because Wynton Marsalis saw one of his YouTube clips mm-hmm. and invited him to play the gala. Well, who's at a Jazz Lincoln Center gala? Some of the wealthiest arts patrons in New York City. Some of the people who are most invested in the idea of supporting the perpetuation of this, you know, great cultural resource. So Joey, in the space of about, you know, 5 minutes, suddenly becomes a priority for a lot of people, people with influence and resources. He's received a lot of really vital support from these people. And, you know, he's had incredible bureaucratic red tape to surmount. There's been a lot of financial insecurity. You know, his family wasn't wealthy when they, you know, when they came out here. And staying here and trying to build a career, you know, there needs to be some kind of capital investment there, and there needs to be some kind of support. Mm-hmm. And he's received that.
And he's now living in New Jersey.
He's now living in Alpine, New Jersey, at the estate of a well-known figure in the professional tennis world, a trainer and consigliere of sorts to Novak Djokovic, who I met at Dizzy's Club and who was, you know, had nothing but wonderful things to say about Joey and what a great kid he is. And that's another thing that's worth pointing out. Almost everybody who I talked to who's worked with Joey, including his producer, Jason Olane, who's at Jazz Lincoln Center, various other people, they all say basically the same thing, which is that he's this incredible talent, but he's also like a really good kid.
Right.
And they emphasize that. He's kind of a regular 11-year-old boy in other respects. You know, he doesn't come across as some kind of, I don't know, weird accelerated genius when you talk to him.
A cold young
person.
Right,
right. He doesn't seem strange.
Right.
He's kind of adorable and he's thoughtful and he's sweet. But, you know, one thing that I wasn't able to maybe put as fine a point on in the piece as I wanted to is for Jazz at Lincoln Center, this is really like something that arrived in a Moses basket, because their mission statement is all about sort of spreading the gospel of jazz around the world, reaching young people, and preserving the art form.
Mm-hmm.
And so here comes Joey, who first of all is proof that the message of jazz has resonated to, you know, the farthest reaches.
Right.
You know, Bali is not super connected to the jazz world.
Right.
Jakarta a little more so, but still, that's a long way from Columbus Circle. And at this stage in his development, he is dealing with canonical information. You know, he's playing standards. He's playing them in a style that is, you know, established.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz Lincoln Center's commitment to jazz education is peerless. Last weekend, they held the 20th edition of their essentially mm-hmm. Ellington High School Jazz Band competition.
Mm-hmm.
And the winning band this year was from Portland and led by a guy named Thara Memory. One of his former students is another person we may have used the term prodigy around, Esperanza Spalding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Joey's not the first person to sort of come around the bend with
sure.
with a lot of talent at, a,
sure.
at an early age, but
yeah.
all the stars aligned. And the fact that he represents what he does, Wynton and Jazz at Lincoln Center and the whole structure of arts patronage that is mobilized by this organization is ready to support him.
This thing about young prodigies, it is not incidental to the jazz business. It is a little more incidental to jazz fandom, jazz listenership. You know, there it really depends on something else. Is the record strong enough for you to listen to and think, oh, this guy's got some new ideas, you know?
Right.
You know, as a listener, you want to hold everybody to the same standard. You don't want to have two separate bars.
Right.
You know what I mean? Let's just talk briefly about a few other people who are either still young or were young recently. Matthew Whitaker's name came up in an email you sent me recently.
You know, I had a long list of people in one paragraph in this piece, and I had to whittle it down to three examples just to keep the piece flowing. But Matthew Whitaker is now 14, I believe. Mm. He's from New Jersey, and he is a blind pianist who I've heard very good things about. I actually saw him at the very same Jazz Foundation of America gala at which I saw Joey. And this maybe speaks a little bit to my earlier point about the support that Joey has received, because Matthew Whitaker came out on the Apollo stage to open the show. He was given kind of a choice slot by one, you know, standard of measurement, but he was, you know, sitting there at an electric, you know, at a synthesizer, and, you know, he did like a Stevie Wonder song. He sang and he played. And people were talking and sort of filing in. And then, you know, the show was running late, so they had him just do his two or three songs again. They were like, just do it again. So the poor kid is then, okay, all right. So he just ran through his whole routine again. So it was really a deflating kind of way to experience him. And so I still don't feel like I have a real good handle on him as a talent. And on that same show, this is the show where I saw Joey be presented, you know, and have her be sitting on the bench with him. And so that's an interesting contrast in frameworks. It shows sort of where the support is being placed, right? That's a digression.
I can vouch for him in that I saw him, I don't know, 6 years ago maybe, because one of my kids and Matthew used to share a music teacher. And it was great. It was one of those visual things that we were talking about earlier. You see this young kid.
Yeah.
And you're just amazed at what you suddenly see this young kid doing.
And was he playing?
He was playing drums.
Okay.
He played piano and then he played drums. And in both, he had it's maybe a cliche thing to say about blind people, not sure, but he had a really striking physical connection to both instruments. Mm-hmm. You used the word discovering earlier.
Yeah.
I felt that he was discovering through every second of what he was playing.
Yeah.
It was really thrilling. And B, it was thrilling that he was so young.
Right.
Okay, so there's some other people too.
There's a pianist named Tigran Hamasyan.
Sure.
Did you see him win the Monk competition?
I believe I did.
Yeah. He was, what, like 17 or 18 then?
Yeah, maybe so. I think he put out his first record maybe when he was 15. Tigran Hamasyan. I just remember sort of Keith Jarrett rising off this young guy.
Yeah.
As is the case with a lot of great young pianists.
There's two that you also reviewed at the what was then called the Allen Room a couple years ago.
Beka Gotsiashvili
from Georgia.
And Gadi Lahavi
from Israel.
Right.
They're both great.
Quite good.
They were 17 when you saw them. I recommend everyone to Ben's review, really kind of more of a notebook about those two pianists on that evening, because Chick Corea was also there.
That's right.
They're both 19 now. Gadi Lahavi has been playing with Ravi Coltrane, among other people. Kurt Rosenwinkel, too, I think. And Beka Gotsiashvili is on tour right now with Stanley Clarke. And so one point I made in this piece is that really no matter how good you are, you know, as a 10, 12, 15-year-old, there is nothing but benefit to an apprenticeship with the right person. We've seen it so many times, you know. Where is Tony Williams without Miles Davis? Probably still a great career, but there was something crucial about that. You know, where is Julian Lage, the, you know, virtuoso guitarist, without years and years of working with Gary Burton, who was a prodigy himself, and,
sure,
and he had Hank Garland, you know? There's just something about a band leader who is both sensitive to the youth and sort of wonderful receptivity and discovery of a young person, but also kind of not impressed. That's something that's really, really key here, is that these kids, I'll call them kids advisedly, they're surrounded at almost all times by people who are just freaking out at how talented they are.
Right.
They hear it all the time, like every day, you know? And I talked to Julian Lage for this piece, and, you know, his insights didn't make it into the final edit. But one thing that he told me was, I asked him, what advice would you give to a prodigy, you know, having sort of been through that whole process and come out as one of the examples of someone who really has found his artistry, you know, and I think is an important, you know, important figure now on his instrument. And he thought about it, and he had two points. And one was, there's something rare about the sponge absorption of a young person, mm-hmm. and the tunnel focus that a young artist can have.
Sure.
And he said, you know, like he wasn't fully aware of how rare that was when he was that age and had it. You know, he's now 27. As you get older, there are more and more things, you know, real life concerns and responsibilities and whatever that crowd out that sort of pure space. And so he said, you know, one thing he would say to a prodigy is guard that, or have someone else guard it. That's a thing that should be protected.
Was he saying don't listen to flattery based on your
age? No,
actually,
because the second thing he said was people are going to come up to you and tell you how amazing you are.
For the wrong reason.
Possibly for the wrong reasons. But he said it's not the right response to be distrustful of that. What you should do, actually, is think of it as a gift and think of it as these people were touched for some reason by your talent, by, you know, your youth, by the combination of the two. And you should just understand that they feel the need to reach out to you because they were touched emotionally in some way, and that it's not a problem. It shouldn't be taken as a responsibility. He said that the natural instinct is to go one of two ways, either to think, well, I'm really special. Man, these people have really put a lot of faith in me. I'm going to have to deliver. And he said that both of those things are kind of poisonous. And all you have to do is recognize that these people saying these things, it's in many cases, it's more about them than it is about you.
Well, that sounds like a very evolved human being.
I think it is.
Well, Nate Chenin, thank you so much. You know, we'll never be young again.
Oh, I beg to differ.
But I'm so happy about that. We're going to go out with Somewhere Over the Rainbow, also from Joey Alexander's first record, My Favorite Things. That's our show, and thank you for listening. You can read Nate Chenin's article about Joey Alexander at nytimes.com/music, and you can hear some of Joey Alexander's music in our Spotify playlist. Thank you to our producers, Tamara Best, Jeremy Egner, and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll see you next week.